And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from New York City, where I am thrilled to be joined by the one and only, some people call her the Queen of Los Angeles, some people call her Momo. I call her Momo. Yeah. Ramona Shelburne, how are you?
I'm good. I think I like Momo. I've just adopted that. Like, that's, I actually like might introduce myself as that now.
You are in studio. We're not talking on the phone.
Yeah, I know.
There's no technology. Well, there's technology, but there's no, you know, nothing has to connect us across great distances. You are here in New York.
You look tanned and happy, my friend. You look good.
Thank you.
You look like you've been in Croatia for a while.
I was in Croatia for a while.
Yeah.
I am a little tanned.
We can get to the happy part later. That's kind of against all, that's off brand.
Yeah, happy is not a, no, I would not use that word.
Grumpy Zach.
Always. Congratulations on the 30 for 30 Sterling Affairs, which we're going to talk about right now, which is the reason you're on this podcast. Yeah. And on this, frankly, you're being whisked on a media tour. I think you've reached a status where you are whisked.
I mean, I've never
been whisked anywhere.
This is kind of a first for me. Like, they have a car service that takes me all around to all these interviews. And I literally like text the driver and be like, I'm done. And he's like, I'll be right there. And then the car pulls up. Like, that's usually for like the Stephen A's of the world. Like, you get the car service everywhere. And like, now there's like a really nice like Uber black car that's like waiting for us downstairs.
So when I do get up sometimes, the security guards walk me down after the show, and I'm like, I don't need, like, I can walk down the stairs. I'm good. And I exit.
Yeah.
And then I walk to the subway at Fulton Street, and I get on the subway. And there was one time when one of the security guards walked me down and said, "Oh, where's your car?"
And
I
was like,
car? What car? People get cars to come here? I live here. I took the ferry here, and now I'm taking the subway. Anyway, I binged the Sterling Affairs on multiple flights in Europe and enjoyed them quite a bit. I took notes, as I've shown you, on barf bags because I did not have a notebook.
Yeah.
I didn't have a notebook.
Yeah.
But are there sections of this podcast where I did want to vomit,
including
one instance we're going to talk about. This came out, 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, something like this?
I think it was last Tuesday, the 20th.
Are you... You worked. I remember you were here for meetings. You've been working on this for multiple years, basically. Are you happy with are you happy with the end product?
Yeah, I think I'm happy. I mean, you know, it's interesting when you have these things. You have so many interviews that you were trying to get until the very end, right? Like, I still go on Instagram and stalk Vista Viano and want to track her down. Like, I still really wish I would have got, like, David Stern. I tried many times.
We're going to go through the list of people who didn't talk.
But the other thing too is there's so many interviews that we did do that never make it past the cutting room floor. And you feel kind of bad about it. I mean, there's just like so many people. You're like, oh, man, that was a great interview that we did. Like, just didn't fit the narrative or didn't fit in within the five episode structure. And so, like, yeah, you always have that feeling that there's more to tell and more to do. But overall, I'm really happy with it just because, like, one, like, we don't do this. You and I write long form. Like, we write and we do, you do a podcast. I do some TV, some radio, but like, doing something in narrative documentary form was a whole new thing for me.
You wrote a book.
Yeah, basically. It's like 150 pages of scripts. And like, it's a huge team that like, I couldn't even do all of it myself. I mean, like, Julia Lowry Henderson, who's like an amazing producer who did the Bikram series. She was like the lead producer on this. We would go back and forth. I mean, she did a lot of the like, it's like an adapted screenplay, right? So like, we would talk for hours on end. We'd go over characters. I would write stuff. She would write stuff. We'd go back and forth. But, like, I don't know how to do these kinds of scripts and screenplay level kind of notes.
Well, there's cool stuff like you interview Blake Griffin and Ryan Hollins about something. I don't remember. Maybe game 4 of the Warriors series when all this was happening and you intercut them.
Yeah.
Want to see, like, that's just,
I don't know,
like,
how to do any of that.
I don't know. But I wouldn't even think.
Totally.
I just don't think
that's
that
all the 30 for 30 team. Like, that's all like Aaron Layden, Jody Avergan. That's Julia. Like, they're like really amazing. I mean, there was parts, like, I remember we had this one call. I almost melted down during the finals because, like, I was doing all of this concurrently with the NBA season, right? And, like, of course, everything ramped up right at the busiest time of our year, which is the playoffs, right?
Well,
like, that's
when
we were going back and forth with, like, you know, kind of final drafts of scripts. Not final. Nothing's ever final until the end. But, like, you know, pretty final. And every single time it's like, you got to read through like a 30-page script and be like, what do I think? What's changed? What's this? What are my notes? Like, you got to listen to the cuts and you have to, I mean, it's just like, it was during the middle of the finals. I remember like we did this call. I think it was game four out in Oakland. And it was like the morning of, and I was like, it's just so hard for me to keep going back and forth between like present day NBA and
I couldn't do it.
Being in the world that I was in and being this like executive producer and host on this story. And I just was like, I'm trying as hard as I can, you know, and by the way, like I have a little baby at home too. So it was just like this incredible juggling act, but it was also, I kept coming back to this North Star, which is like, I always knew there was like something bigger to do with this. And I just wanted it to be as good as it could. And
so we haven't talked in person for a long time.
No.
I'm going to just tell you how I felt.
Yeah.
When I wrapped the fifth and final episode, I was depressed.
Yeah, I can get that.
It left me depressed. It left me depressed. Obviously, Donald Sterling is a disgusting human being. We all know that. I was depressed because I grappled a lot with Shelley and how Shelley is portrayed and how I should think about Shelley. And grappling with Shelley Sterling, his wife, still somehow, she has decided to stick with this dude who walks around with his jumpsuit and his stomach hanging out and is a disgusting person. Grappling with Shelley just forced me to sort of grapple with, like, I just feel like everyone is guilty. We're all guilty.
All complicit.
David Stern is guilty. Like, all these people knew for so long. Everybody knew. The media knew. And like, yeah, the media would write about like the housing lawsuits, right? Like, oh, this is disgusting. Look at all these allegations. They're disgusting. But like, I include me. I started covering the NBA full time in 2011. I never wrote, let's kick out Donald Sterling. I never wrote that column. I just feel like it was a total collective dereliction of duty. And I it made me wonder, are there ownership groups right now in the NBA? And I can think of one or two right off the top of my head that I feel that we failed to cover in the appropriate way, and it kind of made me want to change that. So I felt depressed because they win. In the end, they win. Mm-hmm. Now, his reputation is trash. His reputation was always trash. Now it's just more trash. Now we hear his voice. That's all. Yeah. His voice is – we've just heard his voice on the recordings. But they win. They get $2 billion, and they're together still. So I felt – I just felt like this immense – We have to do better digging into these things in real time.
So I get that too. And I felt that some of that is like all of us in LA when this happened, like we had a little collective guilt too. Like this guy was on our watch, right? Like, and I think a lot of us who covered the team had this sense of, like, yeah, you expose a lot of it. It's all been out there. I mean, ESPN the magazine had a whole story about it. In 2009, Peter Keating wrote this great takedown story, and it was like, all about how awful this guy was and all of the, he had all the housing discrimination stuff, and he put it into a big, you know, magazine story that got a lot of attention at the time. But there's two things at work here. We were in the same position as the players, right? There's this part in the podcast where I say to Blake, you know, I play back this video of him at the white party where Donald's like,
how'd you get the video? So the white party, for crazy, those who haven't listened, first listen. Second, the white party's been written about. He makes everyone come to his Malibu mansion dressed in white. What is it? The beginning, right before the NBA
usually
season starts?
Right before. It was always end of September.
What I didn't know about was that he wears black.
He wears black.
I mean, first of all.
I mean.
How, can you imagine? Anyway. There's a million things. How did you get the video? Is it out there?
So, yeah, it's on YouTube. It was like somebody who was just like a friend of the Sterlings, like took that video, and it was just on YouTube. And one of the producers who worked on this just found it during the scour, and his Stephen Hoffman, he just like found it during the scour.
And you show it to Blake.
Yeah.
Who's so, probably like, mortified that this is on video.
You know, and it's just like an amazing video, right? Cause like you just, when we ran it on TV, we like slowed it down where you could see like, the sunglasses drop off his eyes, and like kind of like he does this like double take. He's like like that, like, and we kind of slowed it down on TV, but it's I knew when I interviewed him, like, you know, Blake was really kind to do the interview because like a lot of people don't want to talk about Sterling ever again. Like, he's just like Voldemort, just like never bring his name up. We're past that, we're through that. Nobody wants any of that stink on them, right? But I think Blake has a lot to say. He had some really, you know, really good lines in the story and perspective on it. But when I showed him the video, he was just like, and you know, it's him as a rookie. He's like young Blake. He hasn't done anything in the league yet. But, and he goes, how did it make you, what'd you think when you watched it? And he goes, it's just so cringeworthy. And then I said, well, who was going to tell Donald Sterling it was cringeworthy? Because he clearly has no self-awareness.
Well, and the players I feel are separate from everybody else because you just get drafted. There's a limited marketplace where you can play. I don't expect a player to come out and say, I refuse to play for this guy.
Right.
Although, you know, Danny Ferry did. You know,
yeah, Danny Ferry did. But not for that reason.
Yeah.
But, like, players could say something. They could use their platform, but it was just, like, a different era. And so we weren't used to, like, and he goes, yeah, it wasn't just me though. I wasn't just because I was a rookie. He goes, he's the guy who signs your checks and it's not like you're not going to get paid, but it felt like the power dynamic was different. Like, he had the power to get you to at least shut up about it or not deal with him. And so most people just found their way to avoid him. It was like, he was like I remember talking to a couple owners, you know, at the time and even since then, like, what was he like when he would show up to meetings? And it turns out he didn't really go to a lot of board of governors meetings. He would send Andy Roser instead.
Did you talk to Andy Roser?
I cannot answer that question.
Did you try? Obviously you tried.
Obviously I tried.
How did your efforts to get Stern go? Because Stern comes off as the guy who, let him off the hook is strong, but you reveal in the series, which I didn't know,
mm-hmm.
that they came close to trying to boot him in the early to mid 80s when he moved the team to Los Angeles after being told you can't and shouldn't move the team to Los Angeles.
Yeah, and it was also, he was trying to tank. I mean, he's like openly advocating for it.
The one time in the podcast where I was like, okay, I kind of respect that.
Visionary,
because,
right?
Because like, he's right. He's not wrong. Yeah. Our team stinks. I mean, Cuban said it. Cuban got fined for it a year ago or whatever.
There was a lot of things, though. Like, he wasn't paying the players. I mean, I've heard all these stories
about,
like,
the most incredible audio you get, honestly, that I hadn't heard before. Because we had all heard the disgusting audio.
Yeah.
Was Sterling at some point early in his ownership saying, I thought you could just could buy whatever players you wanted. And it turns out the league doesn't really work that way. There's been many players we've tried to buy, but we couldn't get them. Like, what? What did you think? You could just call up the Sixers and be like, hey, can we buy Julius Erving to come play for our team? Like, I think that's literally how he thought the league worked.
I mean, he was a real estate guy, and he just thought of players in terms of the same way he thinks of apartment buildings. Like, you could just buy a better apartment building. They were like investments. That's why he was always like mad at Baron Davis. Like, oh, I bought a more expensive, I invested in this apartment building and it's not paying off.
It also revealed that it revealed correctly what Elgin Baylor referred to correctly as a plantation mentality. It revealed I buy them.
I buy them.
It showed immediately early on, again, it was no secret, how this guy viewed other human beings.
So here's what the big question was, is like, what could they and should they have done about Donald Sterling all those years? Okay. And I think that's where the reckoning, that's where if I had David Stern in a room, I would have pushed him, right?
Oh, so he just said, no thanks.
Yeah. Obviously we asked several times, right? And we even look for a lot of archival to see if anybody ever pushed him, like after the housing discrimination suits. Did anybody push him at the State of the Union press conference they do every year at All-Star or the finals? Nope. Couldn't find it.
People, you know I love anything that saves me time. Hiring, not something I've really had to do, but I've heard it is very challenging. There is one place, however, you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. So you don't have to post it individually on every little place you can find it. Just ZipRecruiter does that for you, and they don't stop there. Their powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invites them proactively to apply for your job. And as applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And you've not done anything except sign up for ZipRecruiter and post a job there, basically. It's so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. That's 80%. If you shoot 80% from the foul line, that's pretty good. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. You literally cannot get it at a lower price than that. And all you have to do is go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. That's ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. The name of this podcast, ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Well, let's go back to Shelley.
Yeah.
Because Shelley is... Shelley wins in the end, right? You are careful to portray her as smarter mm-hmm. than people think, as not just this sort of wife who doesn't know what's going on, who's the victim of many affairs. No, but just she's smart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, it was well known before that she helped concoct this plan to oust Donald Sterling yeah. from the ownership trust by declaring him mentally incompetent and then executing the deal with Ballmer.
It sounds fake when you say it, doesn't it?
Not when you see the Anderson Cooper interview, when you're like, oh, this guy isn't mentally competent. And I've seen her on Twitter portrayed as like, oh, she's the Sansa Stark of this. She wins. And I came away feeling, I don't care if she's smart. I don't mm-hmm. care. It doesn't matter to mm-hmm. me. I think, and Matt Barnes in the podcast says she's guilty by association. Yeah. I think she's guilty by association. I have trouble with what's happened in the end, and I have trouble with, I don't want to say presenting her as smart, but like.
No, I get it.
She's in the depositions in those housing lawsuits saying, mm-hmm. one African-American resident says under oath, she called me, you black.
Mm-hmm.
Another, I think a superintendent of the building said she yeah. came and said, Latinos are filthy.
Yeah.
Another resident said, oh, look, it's Shelley from the health department, as if she was regularly
there of that.
Faking yeah. being a health. Now she's going to claim I didn't say mm-hmm. that I was caught off guard. Then she says, I was scared. Mm-hmm. I was scared of this mm-hmm. man. Why mm-hmm. were you scared? Because he was an African-American man with a dog. You were scared. I thought that was actually very revealing. Mm-hmm. She said, I was mm-hmm. scared. So I don't.
Yeah, she's a problematic character, right? Because for all of these years, she is his business partner in this real estate venture. And a lot of her influence on the real estate venture is in visiting she's like the one who does she's the one who goes by and checks on the tenants, right? She's the one who is there day to day more often. Donald is not always like visiting on site. Like the descriptions that I've got of Shelley in the past were like, she would always have binders of folders of all the tenants and she would check on the tenants, right? She has explanations for herself. I sort of tried to present them without as much comment, right? Like, here's what she says. Here's what she says, in the deposition.
I am not racist. I don't consider myself racist. And I listened
Donald
to her
says
say
that too, by the way.
I was listening to her say that. You know what I said literally to myself on the plane? I don't believe you.
And that's the way that I think we had to treat her, which is simply, here's what the evidence is. Here's what her history is. Here's her explanation. And she was a very tricky character because I see things as characters too, right? I mean, on the one hand, she is complicit, absolutely complicit. And I think we make this pretty clear that she knew what was going on with Donald's personal life, in his professional life. And then when we get to the end though, she has this moment where she oust the evil racist from the league, where she seems like there's this clear break. Like after 60 years of marriage, she not only is separated from Donald, but she like helps oust him and get him declared mentally incapacitated and sells the team out from under him. And she does it under the guise of, they were going to disband the team and I knew this was what was best for everybody, to just get rid of it and to move on. We might still be in court if she doesn't do that. Like, I mean, Donald would have taken that. He took them to court. I don't know if they would have had the same procedural exigency. Ooh, there's a big word for you.
Yeah.
To get him out in the time frame that they would have wanted to get him out, the league. They would have voted him out, and then he would have gone to court. I mean, the last time he took him to court, they were in court 6-7 years. That's how long that took back then, the first time. And you saw how they just kept filing lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. Donald is a former lawyer. But anyway, so we get back to Shelley, who, like, just does it all the dirty work for them. Was there some self-servingness to it? Absolutely. Did she profit from it? Absolutely. In that moment, was she positioned well, where she waives the divorce petition? She condemns him as a racist. She said, I can't. The things she says are horrible. And it's like, if the story ends there, you can go, okay, you saw the light. You had a reckoning. You were able to separate yourself from him, and there's a clean ending there. But it's not a clean ending. she doesn't just stay in that place. She goes, there's an erosion over the last 5 years where she's back with him. And the phrase I kept saying to Julia as we were talking about her was like, she's not rationalizing his behavior. She's irrationalizing his behavior. Like the way she talks about it, it's like, ooh, like it sounds like she's defending him now. And I don't know what to make of it. And I don't know what to do. And so the only way I felt like was the right way to treat it is to just present what she did, let her speak for herself, because she does speak for herself. And then
she spoke, to her credit, she spoke.
Yeah.
Did you ask her about these things in the depositions?
And I mean, you heard some of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously not everything we talked about in that part, but she has explanations. Like she, you know, the thing about the one tenant, she says the black MF-er, right? Like she says she never said that, she doesn't curse. Like her explanation is she never said that. I don't want to summarize everything she says because there's legal parts of this, but she says a lot of, I'm not a racist, you know, that the explanation of the guy that she wants to get out.
Like, she
says,
like, shouldn't have to go around saying I'm not a racist.
I know. If you have to say
I've never said in my life I'm not a racist.
Because it's pretty obvious you're not, right? And I think that there is some guilty by associationness of it, and you go look for people who have awful Shelley stories too. Like we asked all the players, what do you think of Shelley?
And
they're all pretty.
Barnes was the only one who said anything other than she was nice to me.
But I think they didn't really like dig in. You know, I don't think anybody like really tried to be like, I wonder if she's as bad as he is. I think most of the players over the years, just she was always really nice to him, to everyone. She was like kind of the hostess. You know, out in front, like she's much more presentable than Donald. And I think that she got, people didn't really want to get to know them
What was interesting, it's interesting, everyone justifiably, we all justifiably focus on Donald Sterling's comments about black people, which are disgusting. But his general conduct, now maybe he's losing his mind by the end of this, so I don't know, but he calls V. Stiviano stupid on the tape. When one of the doctors declares him mentally incompetent, he leaves her a voicemail in which he calls her a tramp. Mm-hmm. Can you just imagine? And then he calls his wife a pig in court.
In court.
Now, again, he was declared mentally incompetent, so maybe chalk it up to that. But like this is – it just comes across as like this is just the way he talks to everyone.
Right.
He talks to everyone is like –
that's how he talks to people.
Can you imagine going through life and could you imagine calling anyone to their face – let alone your wife, a pig, a tramp.
I know.
Stupid.
So this is what happens when you have absolute power. I mean, we've had so many stories of like absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? Like there's so many stories in this world of people who have so much power that no one tells them when they're wrong. And then over and over and over, they just keep becoming more and more isolated in their very deluded world, bubble, whatever you want to call it. Like when you just have a bunch of sycophants and mistresses around you who like tell you what you want to hear and how great you are and pretend to love you and pretend to think you're great. I don't know how you don't see it. Like, I mean, literally like Donald Sterling has this run-in with V. Stiviano and there are like a lot of anecdotal evidence that they still had a relationship after this, after she leaks these tapes on him, that he's like out palling it around with the same type of mistresses. I mean, I've had people send me pictures of him out at restaurants in and around Beverly Hills with like much younger women still. Like, you know, he just keeps playing with that same fire. And I think what it is that it is what he wants it to be. He casts people in a role of like, you're my sycophant. You know, I mean, there's almost like a little, you know, fall of Rome to it, right? Like when you're just sitting around and, you know, everyone's fanning you and feeding you grapes and you don't notice that Rome is burning, right? Like it just, he's so deluded that he doesn't see people for who they are and doesn't even care to. It doesn't even try to see anything different.
What's obvious questions I haven't asked yet. Why did V. Stiviano not talk to you?
I don't know.
Or did she not?
I tried so hard. I mean, I still try. I still like, I always am like following her on Instagram. I tried to find all these friends and known associates of hers from back in the day, from now.
Did you ever get to the point where you could speak, at least ask her?
No.
Human to human?
Never.
Wow.
We spoke to her lawyer. I spoke to a few of her friends. And no one, like, her lawyer obviously is in the story. And it's my understanding, Zach, is that she adopted a couple of kids after this and really doesn't want to be public anymore and doesn't want all the limelight, which is, like, so ironic, right? Because part of the whole reason she leaks these tapes is because she was kind of after the fame and fortune. And, like, me as an LA person, I looked at it as she is, you know, such a typical LA story of somebody who just, you know, equates celebrity with making it. But there's a real sadness to it too. Like, there's a you know, if there's no VC Viano, is Donald still the owner of the Clippers?
I was going to say she
might. I mean,
it's easy to paint her as the villain, as a villain, as another villain, and I don't think she's I have more problems grappling with Shelley Sterling than I do with VC Viano.
I get that. I do, actually, because, like, I did too. Maybe I feel the same way too. Like, with V, it's like, yeah, it's so easy to just cast her as the gold digger, okay? And the woman who, like, burns who starts all this because she was so nasty to Shelley, or she was so nasty to the, you know, even the players, like, hated V, right? They thought she was, you know, they hated being around her. But she heard what Donald Sterling said and was appalled enough to record it and then to do something about it. And everybody else who had been in his world, like, I mean, you talk about delusion, where no one tells you the truth. Listen to the tapes again. V. Stiviano is telling Donald Sterling the truth. Of all the people in his life who are going to tell him, you're a racist, this is not okay to say this about black people, who is the person who tells Donald Sterling the truth? It's V. freaking Stiviano. She knew it was wrong. Like, think about, I mean, it's like where, you know, the morals of everyone. And when you cast people into this story, and you deal with all these characters and they're complicated, right? But V tells him the truth. V knows this is wrong. V knows this is awful. And then ultimately, I don't think she leaked the truth because the tapes because, you know, she felt the need to expose him. She leaked the tapes because, you know, she was being sued by Shelley, and this was a blackmail move, but she still did it. She still did something about it.
Did you, how close did you get to Sterling? Did you get to come up to him in person and say, hey,
I've seen him a few times. No, I never got that close. Shelley shot it down real hard.
She shot it down.
Yeah, and his lawyer, I mean, I had a lot of people who offered to sort of try to arrange a cute meet. Like, hey, I might see him, and if we're going to go out, and I'll let you know where we are, and if you want to just...
Is that the term?
A cute meet, yeah. Like, okay. A coincidental meet, but it was obviously, like, you know, kind of a setup. I can't say who those people were, because I'd be betraying the source, but people who were in his life who said they would try to arrange it, and he never wanted to do it, and then I finally just went... I just went hard at Shelley, and I just said, listen, this is the last... his last chance of, like, if you have anything to say for yourself, this is it. And she's actually in there. There's a recording of her saying that, where she says, you know, we just don't want to have anything to do with it. He doesn't want to ever talk about it again. We can't have another Anderson Cooper. And you have to remember, Shelley controls the family trust now. Shelley has all the power. And so, you know, we had to, you know, I had people ask him. I know that he said no through them. I had Shelley ask him multiple times. Then eventually I just said, Shelley, I have to ask you this, and you have to be the one who speaks for him, because you do control, you know, what is said. And I've, you know, I've seen him out in Beverly Hills. I've seen him around. I've talked to him several times in the course of this, but never, like, to the point of, like, I got to do this, you know, where you got to doorstep him.
Forgive my ignorance. Yeah. Did you know, like, has it always been common knowledge that they're back together? Or that they are together?
Yeah. Like, when I think people in that set... No, I've known the whole time.
Okay, because so, you after know, so one it wasn't year, a revelation to you.
Not that, to me.
To me, it was.
Yeah, so one year later, I think I talked to you maybe about this in and around there. Remember when the Clippers blew the series against Houston? That was
Yes, I do.
The one-year anniversary of the tapes. That was, like, 1 year later.
That's 2015.
And there was that game where they were up by, I forget how much they were
game
up by,
like, six, they were up by 19.
19. And she was late to the game, and there was, like, this famous Bill Blaschke article where, like, she was late because her flight from Vegas was late, and she comes walking into the arena, and, like, right around when she starts showing up is when the Clippers start to lose. Right?
Josh Smith starts hitting threes.
Yep, yep. And
Corey Brewer hits a three.
Corey
Blake
Brewer
misses a layup. DJ misses a dunk. Did you try to get DJ?
Yeah, he said no.
No. CP?
CP said no.
I'm surprised CP, as the president of the Players Union, wouldn't say anything.
Well, without going into too many of the reasons, I feel like I think that Chris has his own like production company and maybe has plans for a lot of the stories that he has in his career and his life, and didn't want to participate in this one. I was disappointed because I always think that, like, you know, stories like this, there's a lot of bites at the apple, right? Like, there's a lot of retellings and tellings, and he was such an important part of this, and so I was. Even Mark Spears got to talk to him a little
bit
this
year. Spears is amazing, by the way. Spears is one of the highlights of the whole podcast.
Of the whole podcast.
People need to, if they haven't listened to it, Mark Spears recounting being in Oakland for game four of Warriors Clippers the night that this happens, basically. And the night that you go into, I mean, you wrote it for the website, that where both teams are grappling with, what do we do? Do we boycott? And Mark's visceral excitement at seeing what they're going to do, and actually thought very eloquent, very interesting. He was disappointed.
Oh.
He was disappointed that they
he
didn't boycott the game.
He was in tears.
I didn't know that. I've never talked to him about that. I forgot that he was at that game.
Yeah.
He wasn't working for us at the time.
Yeah.
It was really, really moving.
I was sitting in the room when he said it, and I was like, oh my God. Like, you know how when you tell stories, like, you have to connect personally to them in some way, right? Like, you relate to it on some level of whatever's happened in your life and your own experiences. And so I know what happened was horrible. I knew he had to go, et cetera. So you feel the moral and ethical ramifications. But, like, the only way I connect to things is through Judaism, right? My family's Jewish. And a lot of them were murdered in the Holocaust. I've been to a lot of the remembrances. And so, like, I have certain things that will, like, viscerally cause me to get really upset, like if I see the Klan or if I see people talking about Jews in that way, I will get triggered. I'll be like, oh my God. Like, and there's that story when you talk about the Holocaust, which, you know, it's like, I never thought they would come for me, right? Like, they came for these people and they came for so there's been moments, you know, in the last few years. I think Charlottesville was a real trigger for me, right? Like, they were talking about Jews and I was like, oh my God. You know, and we have this thing in Judaism, like, never again. And I think for Spears, his family, he talked about this in the podcast and then especially so in the interview that we did, that was a long interview. And he says, my family's experienced this kind of hatred. My family's from the South. I've experienced this. Like, it was visceral for him. Like, when he hears it, it's not just, this is terrible. I know this is racism. It's like, it makes his blood boil. It makes him physically recoil. Like, he's really hurt by these kind of tapes.
He was disappointed they played.
It wasn't about basketball for him. And it was like, you know, I like when he says that, like, there was a moment where they could have been, you know, Tommy Smith or John Carlos, and they're in Oakland.
It could have been an all-time moment.
And
instead, it's like, wait, what did they do again? What did they turn inside
out?
They turned the shirts. And,
Adam Silver had the moment.
Which, by the way, I don't know what you're supposed to do, because the Clippers are trying to win the championship.
Yeah.
And as Blake has said to you and others, you know, it's not like we're sitting there chanting 1-2-3 Donald, you know, in the huddle. We're playing for ourselves. We have a chance to win. And I actually am glad that Blake talked.
Me too.
Not only because he's a good talker and he's interesting and very smart, but the Clippers are now the team – maybe the most exciting team in the NBA, right? They just won the offseason. They have Kawhi Leonard and all of this. And Blake is the thing that changed everything for the Clippers. Drafting Blake Griffin changed everything for them. And people are going to forget that, because now they're exciting with a completely new, different team.
Yep.
Blake, they were decent right away when Blake played. They got exciting, at least.
Yeah.
And then they got kind of decent with, like, Eric Gordon running pick and roll. There's no Chris Paul without Blake. There's no playoff runs that all ended in disappointment. I get that. There's probably no Doc Rivers without Blake. And you can just cite, there's none of the guys they got for Chris Paul without Blake. And Blake is the thing that made the Clippers a different team. More than anyone else, more than any other person, Blake is the reason that they went from disaster laughingstock to, you know, we're going to look back at them as one of the all-time kind of missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Teams.
I agree.
Why didn't they win? What was the internal tension? We've all told that story a million times and talked about it, but I was glad to hear Blake speak so much, because I do feel like people look at when he got traded to Detroit, it was like, well, what a great deal. They salary dumped Blake Griffin. And there's some truth in that. Like Blake's contract is kind of problematic and that trade worked out well for them and they've continued to spin those assets into different things. But like, none of this happens without Blake. Yeah. Blake changed everything for the Clippers.
He elevated them to a level they had never been before. I mean, he was like the potential for Donald Sterling that, to have like a, in the relationship Dr. Buss had with Magic Johnson. Like this could have been his magic. Like Blake was that exciting of a player, that big of a star. And, you know, Donald didn't know how to have that. Donald didn't know how to treat people. Donald didn't understand stars and players the way Jerry Buss did. And it's like really not that complicated, right? Like they're just people. You have to treat them like a human being and not like property. Like they're not, he's not your prize racehorse. Like, and I think it was like awkward for Blake to talk about it. And I think he's talked about it a couple of times in the past. And, you know, it took a little bit of convincing. And so I actually, like, it's one of those, like, when you do this kind of podcast, like, you're basically saying, hey, let's talk about this really shitty time in your life and this really icky person that you are probably really glad that is not in your life anymore, right? Let's relive all that. It's not actually the easiest ask, right? It's not like a big upside for anyone to do it. And I ended up talking with, Blake and his brother, his agent, Sam Goldfeder, his brother Taylor, and like, we talked about really what this is, and I remember Sam saying to me, like, Ramona, look, how is this different from other interviews he's given on this? And I'm like, just trust me, this is a much bigger, it's not a one-off, it's not just reliving it, like, we're gonna put it in the proper historical context.
Someone who wasn't a role player needed to speak in this. One of the founders of Storm, one of the foundational players needed to speak.
That's right. And I was glad it was Blake. I did really want to talk to Chris Paul, but
of course.
It's his prerogative, right? Like,
yeah, doesn't have to say yes. I probably wouldn't say yes.
He did talk to Mark Spears. Chris Paul talked to him, and the audio just wasn't good. And like, you know, there's literally like a tape quality issue sometimes. Like people talk and like you just can't use the tape. That happens with sometimes in these documentaries, but it wasn't like even what he said, it still wasn't expansive. It was like pretty clear he was keeping a lot of stuff for whatever he wants to do later in his career.
I have some specific questions.
Yeah, go for it. Ask me anything. I'm like a Reddit AMA.
Who were you most nervous to interview?
Shelly
was the
Yeah, I mean, I actually know her fairly well, but you have to ask him very uncomfortable things.
Of course.
I mean, you're like, and this is a, she could
nothing
have got up
is
and
more uncomfortable than you reading the deposition from the sexual harassment case. That was, I was on a flight from Vienna back to New York, and I was sitting in my seat with these words going into my ear, and you're my like, 4-year-old daughter sitting next to me, and I'm like, this is gross. By the way, you have a Ramona host voice.
Yeah.
There's like the podcast host voice. It's like, this is different. This is a different person speaking to me.
Cause I'm very conversational. Like I'm very like Valley girl. I kind of am like a New York Valley girl. Does that make sense? Like I talk fast like I'm from New York, but I have this like very casual like in your nose and whatever. It's like cause I'm from the San Fernando Valley.
So Shelly is the answer. Okay.
I think Shelly is because, first of all, she's an 84-year-old woman who could have just got up and walked out at any moment. And I'm literally asking about her husband's affairs. I'm asking her about her history of housing discrimination. And you're basically saying over and over, are you a racist? And this isn't like, you know, and is your husband a racist? And who was this mistress that he was with? And why did you stay with him? I mean, then I'm asking her about her son's death. I mean, these are very delicate conversations to have. And you learn in doing an interview that this is very different than doing the type of interview you would do for a written piece. Like, it's all about the sound. Like, you have to get great sound bites. You have to get them to tell the story, not you. And so, like, a lot of it was, I couldn't just ask her once. I would have to ask her, like, 10 times the same kind of thing. So when you say, like, did you ask her about it? I'm like, yeah, a lot. And that's like the best bite or that's the best answer. None of her answers. And I'm glad you brought it up because it's like one of the big questions and backlash things that, you know, when you put something out into the world, people discuss and that's good. I'm glad. And I really thought about it a lot. Like, how do you write that character? How do you cast that character? Because I think the Shelly character is, if it was you know, it's real life. It's not a fictional thing, right? So if it was fictional, you would just have the character end after 5 years where she has this heroic moment, or at least this moment where she does the right thing, theoretically, okay? But it's real life. And even I kept saying to my producer, like, you know, I want her to embrace that split. I want her to do that because, like, that would have been the morally, the change in her morals that would have spoken to a real change in character. That would have spoken, that would have been a great arc. But it's not fiction. It's real life. And she has this whole history that's very hard to reckon with. And even the way she talks now, there are some statements that you're like, okay. And so I think the best way to do it, and this is what us as journalists have to do, is like, you put it out into the world and you let it be what it is, and you let people hear her for what she is and you, how she is. And then you make your own judgments on it. I mean, there will be people who will hear the story on Donald and feel sorry for him. Like, oh, he got burned by his mistress. Like there were, like Matt Barnes almost, like he doesn't excuse Donald's behavior, but like he really had a problem with V. Like when that long interview, he was just like, you know, he got burned by a mistress.
He didn't get burned by anybody.
Oh.
He didn't get burned by
anybody.
It's
like saying, it's like when you, he didn't get burned by anybody, but it's like after 30 years of playing with fire, like you can't be upset if one, you know, this is the thing that gets you caught.
Is Elgin Baylor not allowed to talk because of all the lawsuits and stuff?
No, I think he could talk. We got declines from him through his, somebody in his family, I think. I don't know how much he can talk right now, like just physically in the condition, you know, like what condition he's in to talk. Like, I don't want to say anything more than that because I don't know the exact
his story is
set up. But no, I don't know exactly what's going on.
He's
going
to go down as one of the most underappreciated great players in the history of the NBA.
Yeah.
The guy was serving in the army and playing games on the weekends in like the 60s.
Yeah.
1962, I think he did that. And he has knee issues. They never win. He's part of the Jerry West teams that lose every year in Boston.
Yep.
And finally they win in 72, except he retires 9 games into the season, either because he has knee pain or because the coach, I believe Bill Sharman, wants him to come off the bench. He doesn't want to come off the bench, or some combination of all that. And then they win the championship.
Yep.
And then he goes on to have this insane life with the Clippers, where it's just a series of humiliations that turn tragic is strong because he's not a tragic figure, but
maybe he is though. And you know what was sad to me about it is like when he sues Donald Sterling for having that plantation mentality and saying like the league is complicit because they knew all the salaries and they knew I was underpaid for all these years, it was the wrong legal strategy. Like he might have won if he just narrowed the lawsuit to Sterling. And it was hard for it to stand up, but what happened was by including the NBA as a in the lawsuit, he made them have to be on Sterling's side. They had to defend themselves against it. And it was hard for Elgin to win that when it was like, yeah, they lost all those games. So it's hard to say that he was, you know, there wasn't good cause to fire him or to underpay him. And, you know, I will say, I think it's good lately that the Lakers kind of gave him some shine, you know, towards the end of his career. Like after the everything happened with the Clippers, at least the Lakers stepped in and tried to honor him and give him some shine. But maybe 5 years earlier, if we would have got to Elgin, he would have had a lot more to say. I just don't know what condition he's in, like just physically, mentally, et cetera, to do interviews like this. And I don't want to say more than that because I'd be really speculating, but that was the sense I had.
I don't think you're going to have the answer to this question.
Okay.
And I don't mean to be facetious, but I'm actually curious.
Yeah.
Donald Sterling changed his name from Donald Tokowitz
to
Donald Sterling. Do you know what other names were under consideration?
No, I don't. I wish I did. That would be amazing, right? But Sterling is so perfect. Like, I do know this.
Like,
okay.
Did you sit around thinking, like, what about Diamond? No,
okay,
Diamond's
too
obvious.
Okay, so I got something for you. We heard this from a few people, so I have to couch this as like this couldn't make it past the fact checker because there's only a few people who had heard him say this or know this, and like we can't verify it. But more than a couple people suggested this, that at one point he was so in denial about his past. Like he's from East LA, like should have been this great rags to riches story, right? Like he works his way out of East LA where his dad was like a junk peddler and they worked the markets there and like makes himself into a really successful lawyer and businessman. He goes and he just totally denies this whole history and was telling people that he was from an English country estate. Like when people would ask where he's from, he was like, I was from an English country estate.
Was there an accent?
I don't know.
Because he sounds like the opposite of English.
Correct. And I remember the guy who told me this was Michael Selzman, the former publicist, right? And another person backed that story up.
Boy,
but
that
like,
is another Trump parallel, by the way.
Uh-huh. And I was like, except that he doesn't have an English accent. And I go, did he ever worry about that? And he goes, nope. Like, it wasn't like part of the concern. There were a few people who mentioned that before he bought into the NBA and became part of that world, like, he had talked about running for political office. That there's another parallel for you. But I think what it speaks to is this strange shame of about his past. Like, I don't know why he denies that so much. I have a theory. It's a quite psychological type of theory. The easiest explanation is that sometimes when people grow up poor, they don't want, and then they become rich, they don't want anyone to ever know that they were ever poor and see them that way and see them in any other way than what they know them as. Maybe they thought they would get rejected. I think there's some familial issues there. There was a messy divorce between Donald's parents, that like only they probably know the details, but we know that Donald and his mom didn't have much of a relationship after that divorce. So there's some issues there, but, so he talks about running for office. He tells people he's from English country estate. Then he ends up helping Jerry Buss buy the Lakers and gets a little taste of Showtime and a little taste of celebrity and just opts for that and just opts to become an NBA owner where it was like Club Sterling for the 30 years.
$12.5 million.
And how much of that did he actually come out of pocket on?
What he purchased the Clippers
yeah,
for.
Yeah, that was the price. But maybe he just assumed Irv Levin's debts. I mean,
that's what Michael Jordan did with the Bobcats, Hornets, whatever the hell they were.
Yeah, Frank McCourt with the parking lots. You know, and then didn't pay all the Boston Celtics legends, didn't pay Havlicek, and didn't pay all the guys whose pensions he was supposed to pay.
Listeners, another key time saver, SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the best way to buy tickets to sporting events like the NBA games. The NBA season is right around the corner all of a sudden. Music, concerts, comedy, everything, theater. It takes the entire secondary market and puts all their tickets in one place so you can stop searching all around and blah, 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 and go to one-stop shopping using SeatGeek. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat mat. It has an easy-to-use color-coded system, green dots for good deals, red dots for maybe overpriced deals. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. I've used it before. They helped me find tickets to Hamilton a couple years ago. I used it to buy tickets when I had visitors coming in for NBA games and they wanted to go to Madison Square Garden. It was easy. It was quick. It saved tons of time. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use this promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today. That's easy to do. Use promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. That's promo code LOWE for $10 off on your first purchase. You mentioned all the people who were interested when Ballmer bought the team, when it was clear it was going to be up for sale, and David Geffen's name comes up. So one of my vacation books was Brian Windhorst's book.
LeBron Inc.
So – yeah, LeBron Inc. I'm holding up a book.
You know what? He's done a lot of LeBron books, though. So, you know.
Hey, Wendy.
Love you, Wendy.
I didn't know this, sometimes you just forget things.
Yeah.
So he has this detail in this book, speaking of Geffen, where LeBron's free agency in 2010, when he meets with the Clippers, and the Clippers sell this as the greatest achievement maybe literally in the history of the franchise.
Oh, I remember getting a press release.
Yeah.
LeBron James has agreed to meet with the Clippers.
You're not going to sign LeBron James if you're
but
trumpeting,
that, you know, good for Neil Olshey. That was his get.
Wendy has this in the book. Maybe it was written at the time, but this is now 9 years ago and there's so much activity that Maverick Carter and LeBron concoct this plan with Geffen to buy the Clippers from Sterling and say, if we all orchestrated this, if you get this disgusting human to sell the team to you, LeBron will sign in 2010. All in one fell swoop. You buy the team. LeBron signs. We revolutionize Los Angeles basketball. And Wendy says, you know, this is a sort of improbable idea, but it was something they talked about. I don't remember that.
No, that's I don't remember that either. That is amazing.
That LeBron and Maverick in 2010 are like, we'd play for the Clippers, but not with that dude. Right. Not with that dude owning the team, so maybe can we do something? Like, that would have been...
But he wouldn't have sold...
Can you imagine the player empowerment articles that would have come out then if they engineered an ownership change?
So I think that the reason why it's so amazing is, one, that it's just really the audacity of it, that LeBron and Maverick think like that. Like, I've had, you know, I've heard another similar idea that they've had. Okay. What if he just makes one of the colleges in LA, like UCLA, like a LeBron school? What if everything there, what if everything at one of the schools is just like LeBron sits courtside, they wear LeBron Nike shoes, they wear LeBron everything, and it becomes like a LeBron school. Why not? Like, that's the force of his brand.
I don't have a good answer.
Who thinks like this? But you know who thinks like
Wendy's,
this?
That's what Wendy's
moguls.
LeBron
moguls. LeBron, that's what LeBron is.
And some of the, it goes into a lot of his business. So I, the last
that's
thing
awesome.
The last thing I want to ask you, because I know you have to go. We're going to talk about Caris LeVert. Caris LeVert can wait for another day. Sorry, Ned. The Nets have had a good offseason. We can put them off.
Yeah. Good for him though.
Good for Caris LeVert.
Yeah.
It's a fair, I actually am a little, I thought their floor would be, a little higher than that.
Me too.
He's had some injuries.
He's happy to get paid.
Yeah, I get it. It's an interesting deal. The one thing I will say is he now becomes one of, and I don't mean to exaggerate, I think he becomes one of the half dozen most important players in the NBA.
Yeah.
Because if Caris LeVert becomes like what, not stylistically, but like the level of flair that Siakam was last year, the guy who's like, yeah, he's in the conversation for an all-star spot, misses it, but he's in the conversation.
Yeah.
If he becomes that, then when Durant comes back, they have a chance to be a great team.
Yeah.
If he stagnates and is just what he is, which is like a pretty good player, great weeks, so-so weeks, doesn't really do much off the ball, blah, blah, blah. Then their ceiling is a little lower.
Yeah, I agree with
that. He is their most important player in that sense. Anyway, you opened the 30 for 30 with this incredible anecdote that I don't think I have ever heard before. And you can describe what it is. My question to you is, did you learn about it when Shelley told you about it and immediately say to yourself, oh my God, that's the opener?
No. Okay. So I had heard about it.
Say what it is.
Okay.
First.
So we'll talk through. Okay. So the opening of the 30 for 30 starts with, a confrontation between Shelley Sterling and V. Stiviano. So if you don't remember V, just Google Stiviano.
Everybody remembers V. Stiviano.
She had the visor and the roller skates, and she's his silly rabbit. That's all you need to know.
Oh my God.
Okay. but
there are certain things you go through life hoping to never hear again. That was silly rabbit.
It actually started trending on Twitter the other day. Somebody tweeted about like the strangest thing in sports, and then
Andrew Luck. Someone tweeted, "Is Andrew Luck the strangest sports?"
Yeah, and
wanted to tweet. It wouldn't even be in the top five for the Sixers.
So
in the
this
last,
is like
Markel Fultz is way stranger than Andrew Luck. Markel Fultz kills Andrew Luck in strangeness.
So one of my most exciting Twitter exchanges in a while was me and Christy Teigen the other day. Tweeting about V. Stiviano.
She's a model, or what? Who is she?
Yeah, she's married to John Legend.
I know she's married to John Legend, but I don't want to identify her as John Legend's spouse. She's a model, right?
She's a model.
So there you go.
With 11 million followers on Twitter, she's like, and one of the best tweeters out there. She's like a really interesting person as well.
I see her tweets. I don't follow her, but I see.
So the other day, she retweeted the like V. Stiviano video. Somebody tweeted it, and then here it is. Okay, ready? Somebody tweeted, "This is how delusional I am," and it's the V. Stiviano video. Okay, and she retweets it and says, "Watch this 200 times in the past 2 days. Downloaded 4 different apps to try to save this forever. Tried to post to my Instagram. Tried to screen record, but it's blurry. I'm only tweeting it so I can have a place to store it for when I'm sad." Then somebody else, and then somebody writes, "People don't understand the power of V. Stiviano, the delusion of power of a V. Stiviano." I wrote back and I said, "You know, you could play her in the movie." And she responds directly to me saying, "Gasp, I was born for this."
All right. So we're making progress to a movie deal. Who's going to play Sterling? You know who would play Sterling? Christian Bale would be like, give me another role where I can gain a million pounds and like be disgusting. Or he just can't be like.
Russell Crowe just did that with Roger Ailes. That's a good one. I always thought like Michael Keaton.
Okay. We're getting
Keaton
off track.
Okay.
The confrontation.
Okay. So Feast of Yano is out around Beverly Hills with Donald Sterling. And like, there was always And there was always like a few other people around too. It was like three or four other girls too, but she was like his silly rabbit. And then there was like an entourage of other silly rabbits, I guess. And she runs into Shelley Sterling, who was just there to like return some clothes or something.
And this is what, like 2 months or something before all hell breaks loose, right?
And they get into a big confrontation and like
Random. Shelley's not looking for her. They're literally at Neiman Marcus at the same time.
And it feels so random because, you know, we think LA is a big town, but if you actually drive around there and know Beverly Hills, it's not as random as you might think because the Sterlings exist in this like golden triangle there. That's like just a, like a few city blocks of like, it's Rodeo Drive. It's over there by Spago and the Montage.
I do a lot of hanging out there. It's definitely your scene.
Yeah, there's this whole like, I mean, this is something that really bums me out that didn't make the podcast because I researched this very thoroughly, but it's right there by Sterling Tower. And if you don't know the story of the Sterling Tower, it's a fantastic one. I'll tell it very briefly. It used to be owned by the Louis G. Mayer Corporation. It's this beautiful building right there on Wilshire Boulevard. And Sterling offered to lease it. Like, we'll just take over the master lease and we'll give you the money from the master, but we'll pay you a certain amount and then it'll be based on occupancy. But he set it up so that there was no like minimum number of tenants. So eventually he just basically kicked everyone else out of the building. And, you know, instead of leasing it out, he just kept the top office floor for himself and the rest of the building is empty.
Sure.
Prime real estate in Beverly Hills. If you like walk by the lobby, like there's nobody there. It's just pictures of Donald Sterling and there's some Clippers paraphernalia. It's kind of amazing. And then you just take the elevator up to the top floor in the penthouse, but there's no other tenants.
I picture every big building in Los Angeles is Nakatomi Plaza. I'm picturing when you said the lobby, I'm picturing the terrorists go in and shoot the security. I'm picturing Nakatomi Plaza.
Oh, I have pictures
Plaza.
Of all of this.
Julia, I assume it's Nakatomi Plaza.
It's amazing. Like, it's like this great Art Deco building. It's beautiful. And like, obviously the Louis B. Mayer Corporation was none too pleased with this, but like that was Donald Sterling. He always got the better end of the deal. Like he always found this like way of setting up a deal to his advantage. Anyway, so like his headquarters are like down the street from that Neiman Marcus.
Okay.
So it's not unreasonable that they would be there. That's like where the restaurants they all go to are. It's not like that unreasonable they would all be in the same area, but they run into each other. They have what's pretty gross confrontation outside, like yelling and screaming. I don't think there was a real cat fight between 80-year-old Shelley Sterling and V. Stiviano, but like it was uncomfortable. And that's when Shelley Sterling decides, I don't want to cuss, okay, because she doesn't cuss, but allegedly. I'm suing her. Allegedly, you're right. I'm going to sue that girl, okay? And so she files a lawsuit and to get back all of the gifts that Donald Sterling had given to V. Stiviano over the years. And this is actually not an uncommon move for the Sterlings. They had done this with previous mistresses and won. And so
they have a template set up for the
lawsuit. I love that line from one of the people in the podcast. She's like, Mayday Malone. She always comes in for the save, right? Like, but Shelley had done this in the past and like V had just been on her last nerve. She was a provocateur. She was like, I'm going around and I want to be Mrs. Sterling. And this opening scene is they get into the confrontation. She sues her the next day. And within that lawsuit, V feels pressure. She's trying to get her to drop the lawsuit. And the tapes that she's been making of Sterling since September, literally September, there's hundreds and hundreds of hours of tape.
At this point, that's about 5 months of tapes.
That's right. And those become evidence in this trial.
Sure.
And V actually didn't mind turning them over as evidence because to her, this was like why they should settle the lawsuit. And so she should be able to keep all the gifts because she assumed that they would never want them to see the light of day.
You see, I just had never heard this anecdote before.
Mm-hmm. And so when I heard it, honestly, you know what the inspiration was? Like Julia Henderson flew out and we did like two or three. We would do like 2 weeks at a time together and just like sit. She would get an Airbnb and we would just like sit and talk story and writing and everything. And I said, you know how we should start this is that confrontation outside of Neiman Marcus because it's kind of everything. And it reminded me, I don't know if you listen to Slow Burn. that was this great podcast about, there's been two seasons. There's going to be another one coming up. The first one was about Watergate. The second one was about, Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton. And the opening of Slow Burn season two is this sting operation on how Linda Tripp got Monica to come to the mall that day when the FBI ends up questioning Monica. And it's just like this great moment that no one has heard about, but it puts you in that suburban mall where the FBI, you know, questions Monica and kind of puts pressure on her to like confess everything about Bill Clinton as part of the whole, investigation into him. And so I was like, you know, it's like, it kind of is perfect because this is really what starts everything is this lawsuit. If Shelley doesn't sue her, B doesn't have any motivation to leak these tapes. And then when she leaks the tapes, everything breaks loose, but then the tapes end up coming back around and Shelley ends up winning that lawsuit and B has to give back all the gifts.
It was a perfect place to start.
Yeah.
And my favorite detail of the whole thing was that she gets mad when someone identifies it as Nordstrom's instead of Neiman Marcus.
Yep. It was so great.
Now,
it was so great.
You might be surprised to know
that someone was V's lawyer.
Okay. I don't do a lot of shopping.
Yeah.
Period. Neiman Marcus is better than Nordstrom.
Yeah, it's better.
And then you refer to Nordstrom's later as Nordies.
Nordies, yeah, it's a Nordies.
So that's a thing.
Yeah,
so, I didn't know that.
Like,
either.
here's what it would be like. Like you'd say, like,
yeah, educate me.
Yeah, there's like the tiers. Okay,
sure.
So like Macy's is kind of like up. It's like kind of upper middle class. Like it's good stuff at Macy's. You know,
sure.
Like you know you can go buy there some good career clothes there. They have some nice brands, but it's not like really expensive.
Okay.
And then I think Nordstrom is like a cut above.
Okay.
Really good designers there. Okay.
Nordstrom's good.
Cut above Macy's. Yeah, Nordstrom's good.
For you, me and you, Nordstrom is not an insult.
I could go to Nordstrom's and I would buy a couple of things, but I would feel like, ooh, that's how much it costs. You know, like it's.
Okay.
It'd be like, I wouldn't go like on a big spree there. I would buy like a few things and that'd be like my nice pieces. Okay. Then there's like Bloomingdale's and then Neiman Marcus.
Okay.
And I think Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus would be like kind of interchangeable depending on your personal tastes. But they both have the kind of design. Like if you walk around Bloomingdale's or Neiman Marcus and you like look up like how much, like you shouldn't even be looking at price tags because if you have to look, you can't afford it. Like those kind of stores. Like you'll look at a purse and you'll be like, oh, that's so cute.
They'll just kick you out of the store.
And you'll look at the thing and it'll be like, oh, that's $4,000. You're like, oh, no, I'm good. Thanks. like it's those kind of places.
I didn't know it was Nordies.
So like Nordies and Neiman Marcus are not the same things.
Okay.
But Nordies is really good. It's just not Neiman Marcus.
We got to wrap up because you have other things to do as you're being whisked about Manhattan. Congratulations on finishing this. It was, you can ask my wife. I binged it every minute we were on a plane. I was like, put it back in my ear.
It's different for me, right? Like you're not used to hearing me that way. And like,
well, I told you I have a different voice.
Yeah, podcast Momo.
Podcast Momo. It's really a tremendous listen. I know how much work you put into it and the end product is awesome. Everyone's listening to it. It's been really cool to see.
Thank you.
It's been cool to see you be whisked about. Ramona Shelburne, I will.
Hey, what are we here before we go? What should we do a 30 for 30 on next? Like what big thing? What should we hit next season?
If
we ever dive in again.
NBA
yeah,
related?
You and me do this.
Well, I mean, the obvious one everyone wants to talk about is the Thunder, right? And like the what if of the Thunder.
Yeah, the what if.
But I feel like that I'm actually having Sam Anderson, who wrote a wonderful book about Oklahoma City and the Thunder, talk about that. Rodman is coming out, right? That's going to be a movie.
Yeah, that's coming out. I think it's a 30 for 30.
The Malice in the Palace would be pretty good.
Yeah, that made a little cameo in this podcast.
Yeah, The Malice in the Palace would be pretty good. Gilbert Arenas.
Yeah, that's a good one. With Javaris. Yeah, that's a good one. DeAndre Jordan in the Banana Boat.
Yeah. Gilbert Arenas would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. You know, that has that true crime aspect of it, because obviously what ends up happening with Javaris Crittenden is real crime.
Yeah, those would be the ones. Well, we'll see what happens. Yeah. Ramona, congratulations. I will be seeing you, presumably, in L.A.
At basketball games, at least.
At basketball games quite a bit this
season.
I hope
I see you.
Everyone, listen to 30 for 30, The Sterling Affairs. Congratulations. It's tremendous. It's awesome. I binged it. Ramona Shelburne, everybody.
Thanks, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.